Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor with McLean's Magazine.
The Liberal government has unveiled its plan to bring 25,000 Syrian refugees to Canada, pushing back its deadline by 2 months. But there are still many questions about where exactly these refugees will be housed and how they will get the supports they need in such a short amount of time.
Many of these details will be ironed out this weekend as the government meets with cities, provinces, and stakeholders. To get an update on the plan and dive deeper into the resettlement issues, we speak with Immigration Minister John McCallum and the head of the Federation of Canadian Municipalities.
The Liberal government is committing $2.65 billion to help developing countries combat climate change. This all comes ahead of the COP21 Climate Change Summit in Paris. We also saw this week a major new environmental plan from Alberta. To talk about all of this, we speak with McLean senior writer Laura Payton, who's covering the Paris conference, and Andrew Leach, who advised the Alberta government on its new climate initiatives.
And finally, the McLean's panel weighs in on the refugee plan, Canada's climate change goals, and the upcoming throne speech.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. This week, the new Liberal government finally unveiled its plan to bring 25,000 Syrian refugees to Canada. But the plan presented on Tuesday differed from what the Grits had been promising in the weeks and months before. After insisting they could pull off this feat by the end of the year, the Liberals heeded calls from refugee groups and provinces alike and pushed back their self-imposed deadline by 2 months. Health Minister Jane Philpott laid out the details.
We aim for 10,000 refugees to be resettled in Canada by the end of December 2015. They will include a mix of privately sponsored and government-assisted refugees. The remaining 15,000, mostly government-assisted refugees, it is our goal that they will be resettled in Canada in January and February of 2016. Full medical exams and security screening will be completed overseas prior to arrival in Canada.
But while Liberals say the security process abroad is intense, the resettlement process at home is a major logistical issue. In fact, this weekend, the federal government is meeting with provinces, cities, and stakeholders to try and work out the exact communities the refugees will go to, where they will find temporary housing, how they can access support systems, and how they will find jobs and permanent homes.
And later, we will be speaking with the head of the Federation of Canadian Municipalities about all of this. But first, to get an update on the whole plan, I'm joined on the phone by Immigration Minister John McCallum. Minister, I know there are many people who have been approved to come to Canada, but you're facing some issues with exit visas in Lebanon. What work is being done to fix that?
Well, a number of fronts. Our officials are talking with them daily. They have come up with a new commitment. They say that they will have everything done in each case within 10 days. So if that's true, we'll have a steady flow of people, which is an improvement, but we're working to make it even better. But we also have two other countries involved, Jordan and Turkey. And we had good news from Turkey just yesterday that Turkish government has identified 5,000 people who are potential refugees, and that's the beginning of the exercise. That's the first concrete move we've had from Turkey, because Turkey is not covered by the UNHCR, unlike Lebanon and Jordan. Turkey is doing it on its own, and so we are very pleased they have come forward with these 5,000 names. We will be contacting those people, and we're confident Turkey will come forward with more. So all our eggs are not in the Lebanon basket. We're also working very hard in Turkey and in Jordan, but we're certainly making progress with the Lebanon government in terms of the exit permits.
So Turkey has identified 5,000 people who are willing to come to Canada and resettle here. But in the grand total, how many people so far have been identified out of all of these countries, and when might we expect them to arrive in Canada? Is it as early as the 10 days you mentioned?
Yeah, I don't have a precise date for the first flight, but certainly in the next week or a bit more is an estimate. You know, we're telling Canadians everything we know along the path, And so I do not know myself the precise date, but we're certainly making big progress in terms of getting our own people over there. As of tomorrow, the number will be up to 320, and within days, 500. So there's a big intensive effort. The more people we have over there, the faster we can interview people. And we're working very hard with each of those three countries. So we are confident that we're making a lot of progress quickly.
And do you know how many people have been identified in total? Turkey has 5,000. What about the other two countries? Do we know?
I don't have that exact number. Initially, we had 10,000. Now you can add 5,000 from Turkey as being given to us on a list. So the numbers are certainly going up. I do not have a precise number when you add them all up.
After they're identified, you know, the Canadian officials have to do their part. They have to do the security checks, the interviews, the documentation, the biometric checks, et cetera, et cetera. Do you know if Canada, so far out of what we've been given from Turkey or the United Nations, have we rejected any cases yet due to security concerns?
We certainly have not accepted everybody. We have rejected some. I cannot tell you the proportion. That's more a security issue with my colleague Ralph Goodell, but I certainly we've rejected a number.
Do you know what those reasons are? Is it links to terrorism? Is it regular
crime? I don't
have
precise information on that, but anybody who is regarded as having some question mark tends to be set aside for the next round, and because we are really focusing on helping those who are both the most vulnerable and posing the least risk. And, you know, we have millions of people out there from whom to choose, so we are being cautious. And there will be a number of people who will not be chosen, either because of security concerns or because of missing or incomplete information or other things. But I do not have more detail than that.
The total estimated cost, your government is pegging it at around $678 million, but that doesn't include funding assistance to provinces and municipalities. How much higher could the price tag go?
Well, we think it's already high enough. That is a large amount of money. We have taken some criticism from people for spending so much. So you asked me how much higher. I'm hoping it won't be any higher, because that covers a large fraction of all of the costs, and we think this is not just a government project, it's a national project. So all levels of government share in the risk and the opportunity. So we think all governments should step up to the plate, and we think we have made a major contribution already.
So does that mean that cities and provinces shouldn't be expecting then some additional funding on top of that?
That means that we have already put a lot on the table. We think others should put some of their own money on the table as well. And I know they are. I've had extremely productive, positive conversations with all my provincial counterparts and with more than 30 mayors. And many of them have told me that they are digging into their own funds to support this initiative.
You are meeting, or at least the government is sitting down with stakeholders, mayors, the provinces, this weekend to try and hack out some of the details. What are the details that need to be ironed out?
Okay, let me tell you about two upcoming meetings. The first is what they are calling a working level meeting of provincial government and stakeholders and federal government officials, possibly municipal government, in Toronto this weekend, an all-weekend meeting, because we know the essence of the plan, the overview of the plan, but the devil is in the detail. How do they decide which people go to which city and all of those details? And those all have to be worked out. And so that is what they will be doing to deal with the nuts and bolts of this plan in great detail so that when the refugees come, we will be well placed to know exactly how they are to be received and where they are to go, and all of that work will have been done in advance. So I think that'll help to put more detail into the plan. And the other meeting, which is a forum hosted by the Governor General in Rideau Hall on Tuesday of next week, which brings together a number of people at the federal level, all of the provincial immigration ministers, a large number of mayors, business leaders, other stakeholders, and we will spend much of Tuesday in a session hosted by the Governor General, which is essentially all of the people who are in the mix talking about what they are doing and how we are working together to make this happen. So I think that's a great event. It is entirely nonpartisan, being led by the Governor General, and we, from all the levels of government, will certainly demonstrate clearly we are working together, but not only us government people, also private sector, stakeholders, settlement people, all of us in one room, sending out the message to Canadians that this is a true national plan.
That was Immigration Minister John McCallum discussing the government's plan to bring Syrian refugees to Canada.
Still to come on the show, we hear about the challenges facing Canadian cities as they prepare to welcome 25,000 Syrian refugees. We take a look at Canada's goals for the major climate summit in France. And we speak with one of the advisors who helped Alberta create its new environmental plan.
Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor with Maclean's Magazine.
Coming up on the show, we find out what Canada plans to achieve at the Paris Climate Summit, how Alberta's new environmental plan plays into that, and the Maclean's panel is weighing in on refugees, climate change, and the upcoming throne speech. But first,
as we mentioned before the break, this week the federal government laid out its plan for bringing 10,000 Syrian refugees to Canada by the end of this year and another 15,000 by the end of February. It's a daunting task for the new Liberal government, but the task for Canadian cities where the refugees will find new homes is equally daunting. Raymond Louis, a veteran Vancouver City Councillor, is president of the Federation of Canadian Municipalities. Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes caught up with Councillor Louis to ask about how city governments are preparing for the refugees' arrival.
Now, he voiced some concerns about the lack of information so far from Ottawa, especially about funding for refugee housing, but Louis started by talking about the strong support for the taking in of refugees.
Well, I can tell you that it was a unanimous decision of our board at the FCM. This is a 74-member board that represents municipalities from all across our country, representing 2,000 local governments. We had a unanimous decision to support this effort, this national effort, for this humanitarian crisis. We have been working together, trying to find whatever solutions we can to help the initiative at the federal level. And we've been having meetings with the federal ministers and our provincial side of the equation as well, along with our nonprofit charitable organizations more locally. So this is, I think, something that we are, at the local government level, taking seriously.
Could I ask about a couple of practical things? I mean, people wonder about housing 25,000 Syrian refugees between now and the end of February. I guess some could, some percentage could be temporarily housed on military bases, but most, we're told, are going to be going directly to their new homes. Do cities and towns in Canada have the capacity in you know, kind of, I guess, either social housing or you know, the kind of housing that could be available at a reasonable price to take in that many people that fast?
Well, you make a good point. We know that it doesn't, it's not 25,000 people arriving immediately, that we have a bit of time. We've heard recently that there are a number of tranches that will be coming through after being properly screened, both offshore and screened again when they come into Canada. But on the front end, there's a lot of a large percentage of that will be through private placement, private sponsorship.
So they have places to stay automatically because their private sponsors are finding them places, right?
Correct. The remaining amount will require as you suggest, a significant investment. And taking up, I think, of some of the spaces that perhaps need renovation. Hmm. So it's not, I don't think in all instances where you would have to have new build, a complete new build, but possibly renovation. And that's something that I think is a real possibility. It does require, I think, an investment that we're looking for details on, making sure that you know, we don't put additional pressures on existing challenging housing situations in some of our local government settings. Vancouver, Toronto, for instance, are already stressed.
This is for social housing, right? Like, is that what you're talking about? Like that kind of places where people who have limited means are found decent housing?
That is correct. But we know that the housing need continuum is all connected, that when you have a specific need, whether it's be social housing or even middle-income people looking to rent or buy, it, if they can't buy, they rent. If they can't rent in a location that they would like, well, they'll find a location, perhaps substandard, and outbid the next down the economic scale. And that puts pressure all the way down to those that are in dire need and find themselves homeless. We can't have a situation where we find ourselves dealing with an exacerbated problem. And that's why we're working hard with the federal government and our nonprofits, provincial governments, encouraging everyone to ensure that they have a full idea, that they understand the entire landscape as we go forward. We move quickly and fast to address this crisis, but making sure that we can do everything that we can along the way to make sure that both the people coming in, but our existing people are also taken care of.
Councilor Louis, does that mean, I just try to understand the specifics here, does this mean you need an injection of funding from Ottawa to update, or you talk about renovating some of the existing housing stock or rental housing stock? What do you need to make this happen between now and the end of February?
Well, we are looking for that detail right now. Mm. That I know that provinces are also asking for that same level of detail and in terms of what it is that the federal government will inject. I know that I've had some conversations with Minister McCallum on this and expressed to him our desire to partner, but also that we need to have the resources necessary. So you're right, it's going to require some significant conversations and perhaps a level of negotiations. We're hopeful, given that the federal government has expressed their serious intent here, that they will properly resource us at the local government level. But I know that they have been convening meetings, and so have we at the local government level. You know, whether it's in a more local setting, like in Vancouver, where we've convened a larger meeting with the faith organizations, with the nonprofit service providers.
Sorry to interrupt, but they're an important piece in this, right? Because they have experience in resettling refugees on that privately sponsored basis.
Correct, and it's part of our overall effort. And so when we put these many, many component pieces together of this goodwill, and whether it's on an individual basis, but you hear these stories of people organizing on a block-by-block basis where they've received donations and whether it be money or clothing and toys and such, and found a place for them. This is what Canada really is.
Councillor Louis, what you say, it's very heartening, you know, to think of it as a national project like this, and I think it's been great that in Canada that we haven't heard much of the kind of backlash they've had in the U.S., the kind of fearful backlash after the attacks on Paris, which I thought was kind of hard to stomach in a way. But on the other hand, you must, when you meet with people in Ukraine, you must hear some security concerns. Does that come up at all, or are people mostly pretty at ease on that front?
Well, what we've heard is that they want the government to do this. That I have not heard the voices that said, do not take these people in this crisis into our country. Mm. What they've said is that they need to be done right. And that's exactly what Minister McCallum has said, that they will do it right. That's exactly what the Prime Minister has said, they will do it right. And now that they've outlined the multi-stage screening processes on the other side of the water, I'm hoping that will allay some fears that some people have in regards to who's entering our country.
Councilor, I'm sorry, I'm going to let you go in a minute, but could I just put one more question to you, just on the front of the pace with which some of this is having to happen? You sound very upbeat about it and supportive of the federal government stand, but can I press you on whether or not you have any concerns about some of the way it's being organized? We've certainly heard people say that there are a lot of unanswered questions. It's been more than a month since the federal election. There are a lot of unanswered questions. I understand that some of the key organizational workshops for the different people who'll be involved in this effort are coming up this weekend. Do you have any thoughts at all on whether you think this has happened too slowly, that they could have gotten off the mark more quickly after the federal election?
In this instance, I think that it is an emergency situation, and it's difficult to coordinate all these pieces. But what I will say is that we do need more information. That I would like the federal government to make more specifics available to us to hear about how they will be, how many are coming, where exactly they intend to support, and how they go about doing that. Making sure that we're properly funded in terms of the housing support component. That there's a difference between the housing costs in rural British Columbia or rural Manitoba than it is in urban centers like Toronto and Montreal and Vancouver, where the cost of housing is so much higher. And so we need to know and have some information given to us to give us the confidence that we'll be supported in that way. I think more information is appropriate, and we hope that the federal government understands this.
That was the president of the Federation of Canadian Municipalities, Raymond Louis, who's also a Vancouver City Councillor. He was speaking with McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief, John Geddes.
Still to come, we find out what the Trudeau government wants to achieve at the Paris Climate Conference. We speak with one of the advisors who helped Alberta craft its new environmental plan. And the McLean's panel discusses the upcoming throne speech from the new Liberal government.
Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor with McLean's Magazine.
Still to come on the show, the McLean's panel weighs in on refugees, climate change, and the upcoming throne speech. But first,
Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is about to take part in COP21, a major international climate change conference in Paris. With a new government in power, there is a renewed focus on the environment and a renewed hope from some that appropriate action may be taken to deal with global warming. The new government announced on Friday it is providing $2.65 billion over the next 5 years to help developing countries deal with the issue of climate change.
Provincial premiers who will also be attending the conference have already started announcing their own initiatives to prepare for a national strategy to tackle climate change. We'll touch on that more in a minute, but first, we're going to speak with McLean senior writer Laura Payton, who's covering the climate change conference in Paris for the magazine. McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes chatted with Payton to get an overview of the goals.
Just the most overarching question, what do you think the expectations are for Justin Trudeau and the Canadian delegation?
Well, it's interesting because, of course, the expectations are quite high since it's just not the Stephen Harper Conservatives. They were sort of reluctant to even acknowledge the link between greenhouse gas emissions and climate change and the human causes of climate change. And so having the new Liberal government, the expectations of the world are raised quite a bit, I think. Plus, when Environment Minister Catherine McKenna was in Paris for some of the pre-COP21 meetings, the meetings before the conference, she talked a lot about science and about Canada's commitment to sort of slowing the growth of emissions and bringing down the emissions to limit the increase in temperature around the world by 2050.
So
the expectations are quite high, but at the same time, they've only been in government less than a month, and they've made a commitment to working with the provinces, and so they go into the talks with the conservative old targets, which a lot of the world would say are not that ambitious.
That's a 30% below 2005 levels by 2030. Have I got that right?
That's right. And a lot of the world wanted Canada and other countries to use 1990 levels as a base. Canada set the same base year as the U.S., which is 2005. And, of course, greenhouse gas emissions were already higher at that point. So it's less ambitious that way. Hmm. At the same time, we certainly won't make our 2020 targets. And we there's a debate about whether or not Canada will be able to make its 2030 targets. And so Minister McKenna and Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, they go into this conference without anything very new to tell the rest of the world. You know, the other countries are going to want to hear, well, how are you going to do better than the Conservatives? And even on Friday, when Minister McKenna spoke to reporters, she said, you know, it doesn't matter if we set new targets if we don't have a plan to get there. We need to work out that plan with the provinces and territories. Now, the government did also on Friday announce $2.65 billion in funding for the world's least developed countries to fight climate change. That money is over 5 years. And so that might be a way that Canada can go to the conference and show that the government is committed to doing more about climate change.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty key. I mean, if you can't set a new target, if you can't yet explain exactly how you'd get to a target, at least putting some money in the window suggests seriousness, right?
Yeah, and Japan did that a few years ago. I'm told it didn't save them from criticism, but, you know, it did show, like you said, they're putting their money where their mouth is. And while they can't, or they have said that they won't be bringing new targets at this point, you know, it does show that they are serious about it.
Laura, do you have a sense of whether or not there'll be a united front among all these disparate Canadians who are there? You talk about, obviously, the Prime Minister and the new Environment Minister, but also premiers, municipal leaders, NGO people. Do you have any sense of whether there's sort of a sense of common purpose or a sense of people staying together?
Well, it's interesting because something like 85% of Canadians are soon to be or now covered by some kind of carbon pricing because the most populous provinces in the country have put a price on carbon through a carbon tax or through cap and trade. Even Manitoba announced last week that they're going to start a cap and trade system in the next few years. And so in that way, a lot of the premiers and territorial leaders are aligned. We know that Brad Wall, the premier of Saskatchewan, is hesitant about this because, of course, his province, you know, a quarter of their economy is mining or oil and gas. And so he's concerned about arresting the growth of that industry when people are already losing jobs in Alberta because of declining oil prices. So they go in united to a certain extent. I don't know if Brad Wall is going to go in and want to be the spoiler. You know, it's kind of one against 13 if you include the prime minister at this point. So I suspect that would be a more muted dynamic. And plus, Canada needs to be seen to be doing something because we've had a lot of criticism from the European Union, from groups in the U.S., and most people are tying Alberta's previous stance on climate change under the PCs. They're tying that to why Keystone wasn't approved.
Right. Yeah. So there's a whole swirl of international diplomacy actually that works into economic interests here. Laura, before I let you go, could I ask you just one question about how you're feeling going to Paris so soon after the terrorist attacks there? It's interesting that this conference, which obviously is not connected directly to that issue, but it comes so soon on its heels. It must have a very particular feel to it. How are you thinking about that?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to going and seeing how the city feels. I haven't been there a lot before. I've been there a couple of times. I don't really know the city that well.
Yeah.
But I suspect that you'll still be feeling, you know, the change after such a horrific attack. I've always argued, and I'm no security expert, but I've always felt that the safest place to be following an attack like that will be where it happened because people will be so alert. Security services will be so alert. I suspect the security of this conference is going to be even more stepped up than it normally would have been for all the world leaders. So, you know, it'll be interesting to just get a sense of that and how the city is dealing.
That was Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaking with Maclean's senior writer Laura Payton, who's covering the climate change conference in Paris.
As we mentioned before, some provinces have been making additional climate change promises in advance of COP21. The biggest commitment came just a day before this week's first minister's meeting in Ottawa. Alberta unveiled a massive environmental plan which expands the province's carbon tax, phases out coal-fired power plants, and places a cap on emissions from the oil sands. Some call it a game changer. I was able to speak with one of the people who helped craft the policy, Andrew Leach. In addition to chairing the panel that advised the Alberta government, Leach is a professor at the University of Alberta and a contributor to Maclean's magazine.
There's a lot of elements to the policy or to the plan that your panel put forward, but you know, one of the headline items, I guess, is that carbon tax. Why a carbon tax? What's the sort of justification for it? Why is that the way to go?
I think you have, among economists, you have very little agreement about anything, but this is one of those things where almost all economists agree that putting a price on carbon, whether through a carbon tax or through another market mechanism, is the cheapest way to get to a particular level of emissions reductions in terms of the aggregate effects on the economy, because it unlocks the power of the market, so to speak, to allow people, firms, et cetera, to make decisions on what emissions reductions are best for them, what emissions reductions make sense, and which ones don't. And so that's what we were looking for in Alberta, was two things with their carbon pricing policy. One was broaden it. It used to cover about 50% of emissions in the economy, so that leaves a lot of low-hanging fruit in terms of cheap emissions reductions that aren't subject to the price. And then two, make it more economically efficient. So on the large emitters, it used to effectively give the rights to more emissions to facilities which had higher emissions in the past, and implicitly rewarding what you're trying to reduce. And so we recommended changing that so that you get a more efficient treatment.
How did you ever consider the politics of this? Did it at all enter into your mind? It's become such a fraught topic, the idea of a carbon tax in this country.
So we were mostly focused on policy. I think where if you want to talk about the politics of it or the important political goals in this, the key one that you'll see reflected through a lot of what we talk about is not making these policies regressive. And because of how energy use is distributed in the economy, even though lower-income households use less energy than higher-income households, they spend a drastically higher share of their income on energy, in particular at the really really low end of the distribution. And so what we wanted to make sure, and this was where certainly our panel and the government aligned very strongly, wanted to make sure that any of these policies were not introduced in a way which would make them regressive. So that's part of why you saw in our report and in the Premier's announcement a commitment to a significant transfer into low- and middle-income households to make sure that isn't true.
How did you find the process in general, the public consultation, the panel deliberating on these policies? You know, would you commend this approach to other provinces?
I think it worked amazingly well. I think our timelines were tight, where we had, in some sense, the perfect storm, in that we had a government that was obviously very committed to acting, that developed a very high level of trust with our panel. The panel worked very well with the government bureaucracy. All of our major industries were, and stakeholder groups were very engaged in the process. We had over 500 written submissions, but among those, a couple of hundred substantial, 40, 50 page or more submissions from interest groups. And probably we could have spent, another 3 months just meeting with stakeholders. So everyone was really engaged in it. And I think that allowed us to, both come to some conclusions very quickly, but also it allowed us to access an incredible array of information. So I think the process matched the circumstance really well. I don't know how well it would work in other provinces under different circumstances, but it worked really well for us.
How were you surprised at all by the public reaction or the public input and attitude on this? Was there anything surprising about even just industry opinion on where things should go?
I think the end result on Sunday, if for anyone that's followed Alberta over the last decade or what have you, that end result had to be surprising. If you'd have painted that picture 2 years ago for anybody, it would have been hard to imagine. And so I think that end result was a big surprise. The public along the way, certainly our first public consultation in Calgary, we had over 400 people show up on a weeknight in Calgary, which we hadn't known was also the first day of school. We were planning, and so we'd missed that in our planning. So first day of school, evening session, we had 400 people show up in Calgary. And I think my bet for the night was 125, and everyone thought I was overly optimistic. So that was pretty amazing. And then we were over 500 the next night in Edmonton.
That was Andrew Leach, a professor at the University of Alberta and a contributor to Maclean's magazine, who chaired the panel that advised Alberta's government on its new environmental policy.
Coming up after the break, the Maclean's panel discusses the Liberal refugee plan and the upcoming throne speech. Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill.
It's now time for the Maclean's panel. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio, and I'm joined by my co-host, Aaron Wary, the Associate Editor for Maclean's, and Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief, John Geddes. Thanks very much, guys.
Yeah, good to be here.
All right, so let's start off with the first broken promise of the new Liberal government. They had said that they were going to bring in 25,000 refugees by the end of the year. Now we're finding out it will only be 10,000 refugees, with 15,000 more to come by the end of February. But a lot of stakeholders, refugee groups and provinces and cities were calling on the federal government to actually delay that deadline. So I guess, John, we'll start with you. If they had to break any promise, is this the promise to break?
Yeah, I think they took up most sort of a half day of discomfort there over that. I don't think very many people have decided to dwell on the fact that it isn't what they promised the campaign, although it isn't. So now the question becomes, how good is the plan they have in place? And the interesting question there is, I think that even though they seem to announce it this week, I don't think we know. Everyone I've talked to I've talked to some people in refugee groups, I've talked to some people from the cities, and they just don't know the details. So I think what we have here is more a sketch of a plan than an actual plan, and it still remains to be seen if they can execute this thing the way they'd like.
So Aaron, how does the federal government bring all these different groups and levels of government together to try and make this work?
Well, if I had that plan, if I knew that much, I'd be the immigration minister. I think it is, you know, they talk about it as a national project, and I don't think that's an understatement. This is a massive undertaking that they are pursuing. The fact that they have pushed it back and sort of changed with the classification of refugees between private-sponsored and government-sponsored, I don't think those things matter so long as this goes off somewhat smoothly or without major difficulties. If this starts going sideways between now and the end of February, well, then it really looks like amateur hour, and then it looks like you're flying by the seat of your pants. Just throwing out a bunch of cliches.
Those are
now.
Good. Those are
thanks.
Good.
But you know, it's a broken promise. I don't think people are going to worry about that too much, so long as it goes together, and also so long as this sort of changing of dates isn't a prelude to a bunch of sort of small adjustments that make that campaign look overly ambitious.
There's just on this point of how they get it done, I think the real work on getting it done is going to be happening this weekend. They have a whole day, what they're calling workshops, set for municipalities, provinces, stakeholder groups. That means the groups that have experience in bringing refugees into Canada. Whole day meetings. They're not inviting the press to stake that out. I think they're hoping that it'll be true working sessions. Now, I think the groups involved are happy to be coming into the room, and they're hoping they'll hammer out some details. I have to say, it's more than a month since the election. I'm not sure why this weekend's meetings were not held last weekend or even the weekend before. It does seem like it's taken a while to get this thing up and running. I suppose new government, titanic undertaking, all that kind of thing. But still, I think they're pushing it right to the edge of what is reasonable in terms of trying to get people into the room and actually deciding on things like, you know, you hear from some cities very wide ranges in terms of the number of refugees they're expected to resettle. Well, those cities have to start finding apartments for people. You know, like to say it could be 500, it could be 2,000 is a huge gap at this point. And those kinds of details just have to be fixed and hammered down in the next few days.
All right. Now let's take a look at the climate change conference that Prime Minister Trudeau, many mayors and provincial premiers are heading to. They're going to Paris to try and set some new goals. Aaron, we heard from some of the provinces about what they plan to do, like Alberta with its big announcement. But the real work sort of starts after Paris, after, you know, the world sort of sets its own little goals. What's going to be happening in the months that follow the Paris conference?
There's going to be some really tricky negotiations here. The Liberals have essentially done something that is basically laudable, which is to say that a climate change target doesn't mean much if you don't have a plan that's going to get you to that target. The problem is that coming up with a plan is hard, and that's probably the reason that Justin Trudeau's predecessors as prime minister never got around to doing one.
the 90-day, they've given themselves essentially 90 days after Paris to craft a plan with the provinces. And this is tricky stuff. You talk to people who know this policy, who have looked at how to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. It's not clear, it's not obvious what the plan going forward is or how you get there. Paul Booth, writing, the former deputy minister writing for our website, pointed out that, you know, even with this ambitious Alberta plan, it still doesn't get you to the 2030 target we have right now. It's a complicated file, and it's the first time in a decade that the federal government and the provinces have sat down to try to hammer something out like this. It's a monumental task, and so it's kind of a risk reward thing. If they can get it done and they can get it done right, it looks really good. If not, it's a big failure.
Listen to what Aaron's saying there. Isn't one of the problems here, one of the political challenges, is that Prime Minister Trudeau has made quite a thing of lauding the provinces for having their own policies, and then the notable ones include the carbon tax in British Columbia, you know, significant stuff, and saying, hey, you guys have taken the lead. We're not coming into office to tromp all over what you've been doing already. And yet, if you just leave it up to individual provinces, it just seems inevitable that you're going to have provinces not wanting to do the heavy lifting on their own. So at some point, there needs to be some kind of federal, either a carrot or a stick. I suppose they want to go with the carrot. Some kind of incentive for provinces to cut fairly deeply, maybe more deeply than the national target even calls for, just to allow for some provinces to not hit that target. And I'm not sure how that's going to happen.
We'll just finish off quickly on the throne speech. So in the days ahead, on Friday, December the 4th, we're going to get the throne speech. The government is going to lay out its new path forward. I imagine we'll have a very different tone than what we've heard from the Conservatives. But what are you expecting to hear in the throne speech from the new Liberal government?
I guess we'll hear the main stuff they talked about in their platform, but let me just throw a little context on that, Cormac. I mean, if you think about what's happened since the election, what's happened is something that often happens to governments at some point, not always this early, which is that foreign matters tend to eclipse domestic matters. Everybody runs on domestic policy, and as former Prime Minister Harper pointed out, man, foreign affairs and defense stuff tends to take over. That's happened in spades with Justin Trudeau. He's been on the road, that's part of it, but part of it's that the Paris attacks, the fact that the climate change stuff has such an international dimension to it, the refugee crisis, and the fact that he's having to go, these are all basically international files. I think the throne speech will be an attempt, at least to a large degree, to pull the spotlight back onto domestic files, in particular this question of the state of the Canadian middle class. He's going to want to somehow reassert the fact that that's what they primarily wanted to run on, that's what they did run on, and the events of the last few weeks of which just sort of distract us from that. Well, at some point they need to somehow put at least some of the emphasis back to those middle class tax cuts, those files that they think are what are going to make them popular in the long run.
Yeah, I'm interested to see how it's prioritized. They could obviously stand and just read the election platform and list off the, you know, 180 things or whatever it is that they've got on there. But I'm interested to see how they prioritize it and how they group things together and how well they give a sense of what the next year looks like. You know, there's certain things they can knock off fairly quickly. The middle class tax cut, they can do that in before the end of the year. They've committed to doing it before the end of the year. There are various other things that have deadlines on them. You know, what's the next year look like? How quickly can they move on things? In what order do they move on things? And what sort of deadlines do they give themselves to get these things done?
Aboriginal women would be an issue. Missing and murdered Aboriginal women would be an issue. And how quickly do that? How kind of time frame do they put on those kinds of very charged emotional issues? And do they put a timetable on them?
All right. Thanks very much, John Geddes, McLean's Ottawa bureau chief, McLean's associate editor, Aaron Wary, and I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill bureau chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.